Hello, everyone, and welcome back. This is Neonatal Review Isolate to Crib. We are going to cover high-yield common topics in neonatology while our focus is board review. Anyone learning or studying neonatology will find this podcast helpful. I will be one of your hosts for this podcast. I'm Dr. Julie Weiner, one of the neonatologists and current medical director for the NICU at Children's Mercy Hospital in Kansas City, Missouri. Welcome, and thank you for joining us. To help prepare for boards, we have invited a collection of neonatologists to help us along the way. All have either passed boards, been there, done that, or are currently studying for boards, same boat as you. Today, we are going to be joined again by Dr. Jyoti Sharma, the other host for this podcast, who is also the fellowship program director here at Children's Mercy Hospital. Okay, Dr. Sharma, tell everybody hi and welcome back.
Hello.
All right. She is joining us to wrap up the topic of apnea prematurity, and today we will be talking about management. So take another sip of your caffeine out there. Keep breathing. And remember, we will get through this together. All right, Dr. Sharma, let's talk about how do we manage apnea prematurity.
Okay. So yeah, management of apnea prematurity is very broad. So you'll have to be patient with us today as we go along and discuss the management of apnea prematurity. I think, Dr. Weiner, before we really dive into the management of apnea prematurity, I think we need to kind of talk a little bit about monitoring. As you know, monitoring in the NICU is very common. That's one of the ways that we take care of our patients. And it is generally agreed that infants less than 35 weeks gestation should be monitored for apnea due to the high prevalence of apnea in this group of patients. But as you know, almost all babies in the NICU have some form of monitoring. Generally, in most NICUs, cardiac monitors, pulse oximetries are used to monitor for apnea prematurity and its associated bradycardia and hypoxemia. Some centers may use impedance pneumography, but I think it's just important to realize that the accuracy of pneumography is limited, especially in infants, by the movement artifacts and the inability to detect obstructive apneic episodes. So it is generally not used as a sole technique.
Yes, Dr. Sharma, I feel like we monitor so many babies for apnea, and a lot of times we'll have to interpret what spells are considered significant and which are not. Are there any kind of thresholds that help kind of us determine what are significant events?
Great question. And as you know, in our practice, we encounter this every time when we are asked, what are the thresholds for this patient's monitors? So generally, most commonly used thresholds are apnea is considered more than 20 seconds. Heart rate less than, most monitors are set at less than 100 beats per minute. For convalescing babies or little older preterm infants, some centers use less than 70 to 80 beats per minute, and this is acceptable. And oxygen saturation generally is less than 85% is considered significant.
So when you have a baby that you're observing for apnea and have determined that they are having significant events, what do you do to treat the apnea prematurity? What are the approaches?
Well, I think before we dive into the treatment of apnea prematurity, I think it's important to realize which patients to treat. So treatment of apnea prematurity is instituted when the apneic spells are frequent, prolonged, or associated with bradycardia or frequent desaturation with sats less than or equal to 85%. That's one time when most folks would institute therapy. Or if the infant requires intervention with bag and mask ventilation or multiple episodes of tactile stimulation. And it's also important to note that therapy for these babies is needed for several weeks until the apnea resolves as the respiratory control of the infant matures. So it's not a one-time treatment. It is over some time period.
So when these babies are, you've identified what population or what babies that you need to treat, what are the options for treatment?
So management of apnea of prematurity, when we have decided which infants to treat, is generally divided into three categories. One is we provide general supportive measures that can reduce the risk of apnea and its associated hypoxemia. The other one is actually nasal CPAP. The last one is pharmacological therapy, and we'll discuss more later on, but the general group of medications that we use to treat apnea of prematurity is methylxanthine. When patients with apnea of prematurity don't respond to any of these three combination treatments, then sometimes we may need to intervene either through non-invasive positive pressure ventilation or through intubation and mechanical ventilation. As you know, we don't usually want to go there at this stage, but sometimes it may be needed.
So Dr. Sharma, we know that the supportive measures are usually preventive in nature. Can you just go into a little bit more detail about the measures and supportive treatment things that are available for apnea prematurity?
So yeah, you're correct, Dr. Weiner, that general interventions should be directed towards eliminating the factors that increase the risk of apnea and reduce the prevalence of associated hypoxia. So the general supportive measures that most often we use in the NICU are the common things that sometimes we may overlook. And one of the important ones is actually the environmental temperature control. It's important to have a stable thermal environment which eliminates temperature fluctuations that precipitate apneic episodes. And we've seen this in our own practice. When the babies become hypothermic, they will develop apneic spells. And as you know, this we in our NICUs, we provide thermal control through servo-controlled radiant warmers or incubator. The second thing that we have to look at is actually look for underlying causes of new onset of apnea or if there's increased severity of apnea. And such factors that we have to look for is neonatal sepsis. As we know, temperature instability can be a manifestation of sepsis, and the presentation of this may be with apnea. A general factor, a supportive factor that we may overlook at times is the head and neck position of the infant. It's important to avoid extreme flexion and extension of the neck because this decreases the patency of the upper airway. Remember, we discussed this in the previous podcast. The other general supportive measure that we need to look at is maintaining a nasal patency. Therefore, it's important for us to actually avoid vigorous nasal suctioning or prolonged use of NG tubes, which are common things that happen in a NICU when taking care of these patients. Maybe one of the most common factors that we have to make sure is that oxygen supplementation, if it's needed, maintains saturations above 90%. Oxygen supplementation is given to avoid baseline hypoxemia.
So Dr. Sharma, sometimes I have used positive pressure or CPAP, nasal CPAP, to help treat apnea of prematurity. Can you explain a little bit how that mechanism works and helps prevent or support apnea of prematurity?
Yes, Dr. Weiner, you are correct. So if these general supportive measures that we talked about does not result in improving the apnea in these preterm infants, then we need to consider nasal CPAP. Nasal CPAP, it's not an invasive way of providing some support. The way that nasal CPAP works is that it reduces the incidence of mixed and obstructive apnea. It actually maintains the functional residual capacity. And it also actually, which I did not know this before, is alters the timing of breathing in preterm infants. It is thought that nasal CPAP is effective in apnea of prematurity by splinting the pharyngeal airway with positive pressure, which reduces the risk of upper airway collapse and obstruction. And actually, it decreases the respiratory rate primarily by prolongation of expiratory time without altering the ventilatory response to carbon dioxide. And lastly, CPAP increases oxygenation by improving the VQ matching and provides continuous distending pressure that optimizes FRC, or functional residual capacity.
So I've typically used nasal CPAP, or nasal continuous positive airway pressure, when infants are having clinically significant apnea. So, you know, more than 20-second pauses in their breathing, or having less than 20-second pauses in their breathing, but having severe oxygen desaturations and bradycardia. It's usually when I've considered using nasal CPAP. Are there other guidance or things on when to use, such as pressure or cannula sizes?
Yeah, as you described, most people will place babies who are having clinically significant apnea, as you described. But just remember also, there's a lot of these babies who have apnea of prematurity, maybe it may actually need nasal CPAP for other reasons, such as respiratory distress syndrome, especially in the infants, those that are more preterm. Generally, it is considered that you can initiate CPAP around 4 to 6 centimeters of water pressure. And in practice, some clinicians may actually increase the nasal CPAP pressure in an attempt to optimize the functional residual capacity. But data is lacking for this practice, and actually continuing to increase CPAP up to 8 may actually over-distend the lungs and circulatory function. So most recommendations are to keep CPAP for apnea prematurity around 4 to 6.
Another therapy that I've seen used is high-flow nasal cannula to treat apnea prematurity. Can you talk a little bit when high-flow nasal cannula versus CPAP would be considered, and what are some concerns?
Yeah, that's it. High-flow nasal cannula has become a common practice in recent times. It is an effective method. Nasal cannula is an effective method, actually, to provide oxygen supplementation and deliver CPAP. And at the same time, actually, it minimizes patient discomfort. But high-flow through nasal cannula may sometimes provide unpredictable levels of CPAP. So, well, it can be done in practice. You just have to be aware that you may be providing CPAP levels that are unpredictable. So what happens if CPAP fails to control? I think this is the time when CPAP is not effective and your apneic spells are becoming worse. Then non-invasive positive pressure ventilation can be considered, and it is a useful tool to augment the beneficial effects of CPAP.
Okay, Dr. Sharma, as we move into other therapies, mainly pharmacological therapies, what is the most common that we use for apnea prematurity?
Yes, so let's move on to pharmacological therapy, because using general measures and CPAP may not always be sufficient, that you may have to consider pharmacological therapy. So when talking about pharmacological therapy for apnea of prematurity, the general group of drugs that is used is methylxanthines. Methylxanthines cause stimulation of the respiratory neural output by inhibition of adenosine receptors. That's how they work. And the two methylxanthines that generally are used in apnea of prematurity are caffeine and theophylline. As you are all aware, now in practice we use caffeine, but I will discuss theophylline also, because it used to be an old treatment, but now we know a lot more about caffeine, and it is the preferred pharmacological therapy for apnea of prematurity. And caffeine is the preferred therapy because of its longer half-life, its wider margin of safety, and less adverse side effects as compared to theophylline.
Well, I have to say, caffeine's the preferred drug of choice by me also. I definitely need my cup of caffeine every day.
Well, yeah, sometimes your babies also. So I think let's dive into the mechanism of action of methylxanthines. And as I mentioned, they are competitive inhibitors of adenosine receptors.
So adenosine is actually an inhibitory neuromodulator of respiratory drive. Blockage of its receptors by methylxanthines results in increased ventilatory responsiveness to carbon dioxide, reversal of central hypoxic depression of breathing, and enhanced force of diaphragmatic contraction and improved muscle tone. Adenosine acts in many ways to enhance respiratory function. It is an inhibitory modulator of respiratory drive. Two, blockage of its receptors by methylxanthine results in increased ventilatory responsiveness to carbon dioxide. Three, reversal of the central hypoxic depression of breathing. Four, enhance respiratory force of diaphragmatic contraction. And five, through pharyngeal muscle tone. It is interesting to note that the respiratory neural output is increased within 5 minutes after IV loading dose of caffeine. So there was a study of 51 patients with a mean gestational age of 29 weeks, where they found 2 hours after loading with caffeine, there was increased cerebral cortical activity, there was decreased transcutaneous carbon dioxide, an increase in mean arterial pressure. Caffeine may also reduce the effects of hypoxia on perinatal white matter injury, and this is actually thought to be due to its ability to inhibit both pro- and anti-inflammatory mechanisms, which again are mediated by the adenosine receptor.
So, Dr. Sharma, are there evidence that methylxanthine therapies are effective in treating apnea prematurity?
Again, Dr. Weiner, a very important question, and I have to say there, and I'm going to go through some of the studies. There's been a lot more done around methylxanthine therapy in babies with apnea prematurity in the last 2 decades. So there is a systematic review in 2010 that looked at 5 trials, showed that short-term effects of methylxanthine therapy compared to those who received placebo, patients were less likely to have apneic episodes and require assisted ventilation. So compared to placebo, patients who received methylxanthine therapy did better. And then, as you are aware, and I think many of our listeners are aware of the CAP trial, or the caffeine for apnea of prematurity trial, where in this trial of 2006 preterm infants with a birth weight ranging from 500 to 1250 grams, this study reported no difference in the rate of death, abnormal brain ultrasound, and neck between the treated and the control groups. However, caffeine therapy was associated with reduced risk for PDA ligation and BPD, earlier discontinuation of supplemental oxygen, and a lower age at the time of last endotracheal tube use. So definitely this study did have some positive effects.
Yeah, it looks like caffeine really helps the babies breathe better.
Yeah, you are true. And actually more interesting, there are follow-up studies from this group of patients. So in a subsequent follow-up of the CAP trial, for infants who required positive pressure ventilation, caffeine benefit was assured with short duration of mechanical ventilation compared with placebo. The earlier discontinuation of positive airway pressure support with caffeine indirectly suggests a decrease in the frequency of apnea, and the reduction of BPD suggests that caffeine might have a preventive role in the development of this disorder.
So I think that's why now it's very common in our practice that we prophylactically use caffeine in our preemie babies, especially our elbow babies less than 28 weeks, to help avoid these intubation, mechanical ventilation, and then also to aid in extubation.
You are very true, because it's only after the CAP study that we started doing this, realizing that actually it's not only for prevention of apnea of prematurity, but it has other beneficial effects. I want to talk about another interesting study of prophylactic caffeine use. Actually, this was a large retrospective study from the Canadian Neonatal Network. They studied infants less than 29 weeks gestation. And what they did was they classified the early caffeine group who received caffeine in the first 2 days of life and the late caffeine group, those that received caffeine on or after the third day of life. In their multivariate analysis, neonates in the early caffeine group actually had a small but statistically significant lower risk of composite outcome of death or BPD. However, if they looked further, most of this effect was due to a reduction in the incidence of BPD as there was no difference in mortality. Apart from that finding, the early caffeine group was less likely to have a PDA or undergo surgical intervention for PDA. But there was no difference in necrotizing enterocolitis, severe neurological injury, or ROP. This cohort was followed up at 18 to 24 months, corrected postmenstrual age. And actually, they found that the patients that had received caffeine had better neurodevelopmental outcome with early use as opposed to late use of caffeine. So again, another study that shows that early use caffeine is beneficial. Now, having said that, there are two other studies that showed no additional benefit of caffeine when initially treated with either CPAP or mechanical ventilation.
So Dr. Sharma, now that you kind of highlighted all the great things about caffeine, are there side effects that we should be worried about?
Yes, as with any other drug, methylxanthines also have side effects. So the main adverse side effect of methylxanthines is tachycardia. And as you know, it is actually less frequent with caffeine than with theophylline. Theophylline can cause gastroesophageal reflux due to delayed gastric emptying, but this is not clinically significant. Methylxanthines also increases metabolic rate, but the long-term impact of it is unknown.
Is there long-term neurodevelopmental outcome data?
As you know, we as neonatologists, we always want to look at long-term neurodevelopmental data, right, and outcomes. So the caffeine apnea of prematurity trial did do follow-ups at 5 and 11 years. Although data is limited, it did show some findings. One, the neurobiological outcome is not affected by neonatal caffeine therapy and that there may be some benefit from caffeine compared to placebo. Overall, similar cognitive outcome and academic performance between the two groups at 5 and 11 years of age, but neonatal caffeine therapy reduced rates of developmental coordination disorder at 5 years and motor impairment at 11 years. At 11 years, the caffeine-treated group performed better than the control on tests for fine motor coordination, visual motor integration, visual perception, and visuospatial organization. So in summary, these data support the long-term safety and potential efficacy of caffeine therapy for apnea of prematurity. And we have already discussed the neurodevelopmental outcome in the early versus late caffeine group already.
Can you comment on caffeine versus theophylline? Why is caffeine preferred and the most commonly used drug of choice for treating apnea prematurity?
Sure, I will kind of slow down and discuss this in detail because this is another potential questions that can come up in the board exam. So caffeine has therapeutic advantages over theophylline. One, it has a long half-life, which ranges from anywhere from 60 to 100 hours. Caffeine can be given once a day instead of more frequent dosing as with theophylline. Its enteral absorption is more reliable, and caffeine has a wider therapeutic index, which minimizes side effects. The last thing is that monitoring serum levels is generally required in patients with theophylline because of its small margin of safety and greater variability of absorption, while as caffeine levels are usually only monitored if there are signs of toxicity. A systematic review of 5 trials reported similar rates of reduction of apnea and bradycardia during the first week between caffeine and theophylline. But adverse reactions such as tachycardia and feeding intolerance was greater in the theophylline group compared to the caffeine group. Therefore, as mentioned earlier, caffeine is the preferred methylxanthine for treatment of apnea of prematurity.
So the conclusion is that caffeine's really preferred for prophylactic agent to prevent apnea prematurity due to its longer half-life, wider margin of safety, and lower frequency at adverse effects. So Dr. Sharma, what doses do we normally use?
Yes, so dosing of caffeine, it's important to kind of realize the forms that are available. So for caffeine, the loading dose is 20 per kg of caffeine citrate, which is equivalent to 10 per kg of caffeine base. And just remember, it can be given both intravenously and enterally. And then we start the daily maintenance dose, and this ranges from 5 to 10 milligrams per kg per dose, which is equivalent to 2.5 to 5 milligrams per kg of caffeine base. And this should be started about 24 hours after the loading dose. And again, can be given both intravenously and orally. It's also important to note that the efficacy and safety of higher doses are unknown, and that additional postnatal increased dosing after the first week of therapy may be needed, because as the baby matures and grows, the metabolism also increases. Therefore, you will require higher doses. One of the things that always comes up in clinical practice is folks asking if we need to monitor caffeine level. It's important to know that routine measurements of caffeine level is not necessary. The only time that you would want to do a caffeine level if there are signs of toxicity, because as you know, caffeine has a wide therapeutic index, and also that the dose response relationship is not established yet.
So Dr. Sharman, now that we've talked about kind of when to start caffeine, is there any guidance on when to stop the caffeine and treatment?
Yes, that's very true. Yes, we started caffeine, but the question is, when do we stop caffeine? Does the patient go home on caffeine? In short, data is lacking on when to discontinue therapy. But in practice, and based on the natural cause of apnea of prematurity, most clinicians would discontinue caffeine when the infant reaches a post-menstrual age, anywhere from 32 to 34 weeks gestation, and there have been no apneic episodes requiring intervention at least for 5 days. Some folks wait for 7 days. And it's also important to remember that it takes up to 7 days for caffeine to be eliminated from the system of the neonate. And this is, as you all know, because of the long half-life. Cardiorespiratory monitoring is continued until the infant is discharged home, because the mean half-life of caffeine is approximately 87 days in a patient at post-menstrual age of 35 weeks gestation. Sometimes in practice, we may stop caffeine and then the patient will have more frequent episodes of apnea or bradycardia desaturation. So the question always comes up, when do we restart? The answer to that is actually caffeine really needs to be reinstituted, because most of these episodes are short and self-resolved. I think the only time that we should consider restarting caffeine is if the infant requires intervention with bag mass treatment.
In the adults, using caffeine or coffee can lead to increased heartburn or reflux. Is there any kind of evidence that shows either caffeine or just apnea prematurity is made worse by gastroesophageal reflux?
Dr. Weiner, as you know, all babies, and especially all premature babies, will have some reflux, gastroesophageal reflux, due to decreased muscle tone. But there is no evidence to show that gastroesophageal reflux is associated with apnea prematurity. And treatment of presumed or proven gastroesophageal reflux solely just for reduction in apnea events is not supported by current available evidence. So I think it's important to remember that.
So if you have a patient that's having apnea prematurity, Is that effective by a blood transfusion? Would that be a consideration for treatment?
So another common question in clinical practice. So interestingly, in 2012, there was a very elaborate study done that used a computer algorithm to detect apnea, bradycardia, and oxygen desaturations in continuously recorded physiological data from 67 preterm infants. And this showed that patients had decreased apnea for 3 days after blood transfusion compared to the 3 days before the transfusion. The authors of this study also reported that the probability of an apnea event in a 12-hour period was higher with a lower hematocrit adjusted for post-menstrual age. If you look at the results of the study, it suggests that anemia may increase the likelihood of apnea of prematurity and that blood transfusions may result in a short-term reduction of apnea. But there is no data currently to indicate that blood transfusion results in long-term reduction in apnea.
Okay, now that we've treated the apnea, discuss some of the unique considerations and our weaning and now are off the caffeine. When do we decide to discharge babies, or what are special considerations for babies that have apnea prematurity as we plan for home?
Another important question that comes up in clinical practice. So, a few things to remember. Home cardiorespiratory monitoring is not needed for infants who are otherwise ready for discharge and remain free of any episode of bradycardia, apnea, or oxygen desaturations for 5 to 7 days, as the risk for subsequently clinically significant apnea is very low. I think that's kind of important to know. The other question comes up is actually, when do we discharge a baby who is off caffeine or on caffeine? So again, if caffeine has been recently discontinued, it is generally advised that the infant not be discharged home unless there is an event-free period of at least 7 days to allow caffeine to be eliminated or to reach low subtherapeutic levels given its long half-life. I think in clinical practice, we also see brief, isolated bradycardic episodes that spontaneously resolve and feeding-related events that resolve with interruption of feeding. And these are common in convalescing preterm infants. And these actually generally do not delay discharge and do not require any home monitoring. But it is also important to remember that discharge criteria vary by center. In general, most centers wait until infants are free of apnea and off caffeine therapy before discharge. While some may discharge infants home with cardiorespiratory monitoring with or without caffeine therapy. I think the most important thing to remember is that if the infant is to be monitored at home prior to discharge, the parents or the primary care provider who will take care of the patient at home, they must demonstrate proficiency in managing the monitor and providing appropriate intervention in an event the baby has an apneic spell, either through stimulation and also be ready to perform cardiorespiratory resuscitation. Therefore, parents or care providers need to have CPR knowledge. Even when these babies are sent on home monitoring, almost all of them can be discontinued around 43 to 44 weeks post-menstrual age, because that's when, as we had discussed in a previous podcast, almost all apnea prematurity resolves, except for those that may have bronchopulmonary dysplasia. That takes a little bit longer to resolve.
Dr. Sharma, thank you for talking about the management of apnea prematurity. Can you provide a summary of the things that you've talked about in this podcast regarding treatment of the apnea of prematurity?
Thank you, Dr. Weiner. We covered many different aspects of the management of apnea of prematurity. So to summarize, we need to monitor all babies that are at risk for apnea of prematurity in the NICU, which generally all infants who are less than 35 weeks gestation. The management is a combination of general supportive measures that decrease the risk of apnea and its associated hypoxemia. The other management is nasal CPAP. And then lastly, pharmacological therapy with methylxanthines. If patients fail to respond to these interventions, they may require intubation, mechanical ventilation, or non-invasive positive pressure ventilation. Supportive care should be focused on factors that eliminate the risk of apnea, and these are to maintain a stable thermal environment, nasal patency, avoid extremes of neck flexion and extension, and of course, identifying underlying causes of apnea such as sepsis. Nasal CPAP reduces the risk of upper airway collapse and obstruction and increases oxygenation. For pharmacological therapy of apnea of prematurity, caffeine is the preferred agent because of its long half-life, wide safety margin, and associated lower incidence of adverse effects. Early caffeine can be used in extremely low birth weight infants within the first 2 days of life to avoid intubation and mechanical ventilation or to facilitate early extubation. Consider discontinuation of caffeine once the infant has reached a post-menstrual age of 32 to 34 weeks and has had at least a 5-day period free from apnea, bradycardia, or desaturation. Lastly, readiness for discharge. A clinically significant apneic event-free period before discharge of 5 to 7 days is commonly used, but again, varies by center. The specific event-free period may need to be individualized by some. For some infants, depending on the gestational age at birth, the nature and severity of recorded events. Lastly, most infants have complete resolution of their apneic events by postmenstrual age 43 to 44 weeks gestation.
Dr. Sharma, thank you for walking us through apnea prematurity, defining what it is, covering the pathogenesis, and then the management. This concludes the 3 episodes covering apnea prematurity. We hope that this will give you a better understanding on apnea prematurity. This is Neonatology Review, Isolate to Crib. I'm Dr. Julie Weiner. Thank you for listening, and please join us next time where we will cover more topics in neonatology.